the human, it's just one among the myriad things. Human societies are one of many other kinds of societies, ant societies and so on, right? The human organism is not radically different in kind from other kinds of organisms.
You're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes, and I'm Frances Garrett. Today I'm speaking with Kathy Lin. Kathy is a visiting assistant professor at Oberlin College in religious ethics and critical thought. We're talking today about her doctoral dissertation called Religious Change as Seen Through Buddhist Environmentalism, which she completed in 2023 at Georgetown University. Kathy's research focuses on East Asian Buddhism, environmentalism, theories and methods in the study of religion, and moral philosophy as informed by ordinary language philosophy. I'm so interested to hear you talk more about your defense of Buddhist environmentalism and your critique of some aspects of Buddhist environmentalism or writing on that topic, and then also how you use philosophy of language and theoretical biology and other areas of thinking to explore this topic. And so to get us started, I wonder if you could give us a high-level overview of your dissertation.
I would say the first is to give a theoretical account of what religious change is. So as I first started reading in the literature on Buddhism and environmentalism, there are these folks happy to talk about Buddhist environmentalism as somehow self-evident, straightforward extrapolations of compassion, you know, and so on and so forth. And then some other concerns, critical concerns around historically speaking, Buddhists didn't act in this way. And so my challenge there in thinking through how to make sense of those criticisms, be responsible to them, involved putting together a theoretical, you know, piece of work around accounting for how we want to link up past and present. So that's really a big key part of my project. As I kind of went along, I realized that in thinking through some of the theoretical pieces of what religious change was like, I ended up realizing that I needed to do as well something like a defense of what religious exemplarity is, and then work out what marks might be relevant if we're thinking about something like a Buddhist environmentalist exemplar. Those are two pieces. The first part was trying to figure out that theoretical apparatus around how to think about religious change. And then as I went along, I realized really thinking about people and how they're engaging in this kind of change.
You draw on philosophy of language and ordinary language philosophers in particular to talk about how Buddhist doctrines like the doctrine of interdependence can be read in a pragmatic register, you say. Can you explain how and why you use philosophy of language to explore Buddhist environmentalism in particular and what it means to read a Buddhist concept in a pragmatic register? What insight does that approach give us?
Yeah. So what's valuable about sort of reading Buddhist concepts in this way is that it really forces us to see how an idea is in fact used interpersonally among people in a particular, you know, context, particular speech situation. You know. But thinking about a total speech situation then, right? Like, what would that be? And then we start thinking about the various institutions that people are navigating around and with, the kinds of norms that people are expected to comport with or not comport with, the kinds of conventions that are set up in a particular social world. So what ends up happening is we end up thinking about what political theorists might call the basic structure of a whole society in which you have a total speech situation. And so my interest in doing that is to say, if we just think about our ordinary course of our own lives, our present day circumstances, we don't go around in our relations with our colleagues and our friends and our family and so on, just busting out these really big, like heavy duty core concepts all the time. We don't kind of go around saying that here's another instance in which we can apply this idea, but rather we're in the society with its basic structure. We speak in whole speech situations and we comport with various conventions that are around, that are in the air around us, or we don't, we might undermine them sometimes, right? And that's an important part of what, you know, a speech act might do. So So what I wanted to get at was the thought that, you know, the past is really no less complicated than the present in this way. And people in the past are smart, like we are smart, you know, and sort of like the ways then that we think of people speaking to each other and building out their societies and upholding some of their norms, contesting some other ones, the ways that they go about doing that are going to be multivalent, complex, and interesting. So that's what I want out of the pragmatics of language, out of the, call it, ordinary language philosophers and so on, is that they're really going to help us keep our eye trained on that dimension of things. And that way, we're not going back to a scholastic layout of here's the Four Noble Truths, here's the Eightfold Noble Path, like, of course, they thought about these things, right? But we don't go around in our ordinary lives thinking, today, I'm not going to kill anybody. What I want from the ordinary language philosophers is this ability to get into a total speech situation within a whole society, make it come alive for us.
So you're trying to think back into the past and imagine how these fundamental Buddhist concepts that now we often look back to and rely on texts or doctrinal systems to imagine, you're trying to imagine regular people in their lives and how they might have used these concepts just in the way that we do or don't.
Yeah. That's the goal.
It's a way of thinking about how to look at the past rather than drawing on doctrinal systems and textual histories, as is often the case in our field in Buddhist studies. Even though we can't know how people in these communities use these words in the past, we can at least imagine that they would have had a similar kind of approach to it that we do, is what you're suggesting.
Yeah.
Not similar approach to the words, but similar approach to language.
To language, yeah. Just speaking, yeah. We do have windows of insight into this all the time. There are things we can infer by reading certain kinds of things. An example that I have is, What's an example of suffering, right? That's a big, heavy-hitting doctrinal concept, right? What kind of content would actually be the ordinary way in which someone might have experienced that? Well, there's the story of Half Khasi in the Terigata, where she says, I used to be worth the whole of the kingdom in my value. And you say, value of what? And then you realize she's talking about prostitution. She's talking about selling herself. And then she says, now I'm only worth half this amount, right? And it's just, that's a total speech situation. For me, when I hear that, that's someone ordinary going about their lives. There's a certain approach that would sort of, I'll call it, overvalue what a moral concept is. And I'll try to explain that in a moment. And there's a certain other approach that might undervalue what a moral concept is and what it can do. An approach that would overvalue what a moral concept can do would be straight philosophical line of argumentation or something, you know, the doctrine of compassion, and therefore when you push out certain conclusions from doctrinal ideas. What I mean by overvaluing a moral concept is that it might be asking that idea to do too much, because as we know, just by appeals to compassion, it works sometimes, but my thought is we want to get into the total speech situation. We want to think about settings in which appeals to compassion do work. It's important that that works for us relationally and so on, but there are limits to that. But on the other hand, you might undervalue what an idea like compassion can do. And that's something that I see in a suspicious reading of Buddhist history, where we think that, look, monks and nuns weren't these ideal beings. They also exploited natural resources. They also participated in institutions of slavery, which indeed it seems like they did, you know, things like that, right? Where you say, if you dig just a little deeper, you see it's really about just interests and power. And I think that's undervaluing the set of doctrinal concepts that's working within a system of concepts that the Buddhist worldview is going to be about. So if we want to not do either of those things, not say that in the end it's just about power and interests and people just doing whatever they want for their own interests and for their own sake and so on. And if, on the other hand, we don't want to be over-reliant on any particular doctrinal idea like compassion, and say that, like, because Buddhists have a doctrine of compassion, we can just keep on applying the doctrine of compassion endlessly. People don't work like that either. Try to get into the middle from both of those approaches. That's the real value of something like a pragmatic approach to language that I introduce. Let's try to get back into the speech situation within the whole society, within the basic structure of that society, and so on.
Your work offers this very detailed history of Buddhist environmentalism in the 20th century industrial West, which I found fascinating and valuable. And so you talk in that context about how environmentalists give, and I'm quoting you here, a particularly context-appropriate response to the moral concepts embedded in the 20th century industrial political economy in their translation of Pratityasamutpada as interdependence. So in other words, you're looking into how the dominance of moral concepts like growth or progress gave rise to this need for alternative concepts like interdependence. Can you, first of all, explain how these ideas are moral concepts?
So the thought of a concept being moral is the thought that when we speak, that there's value judgments embedded in the ideas we use, that there's not a clear and obvious divide that can be made in the words we use and the concepts we deploy between straightforwardly descriptive, just reporting the facts of a situation or something, versus a normative, more evaluative sense of what's going on. If we're thinking about refusing a fact-value distinction in relation to what a moral concept is, it would be to say that maybe all concepts, but certainly some, have a particular way in which descriptive and normative elements of our speech are together in that concept, that there's no kind of real way to take them apart. Certain concepts that I highlighted, for example, growth or progress, but also interdependence, to be these kinds of concepts. There's not a clear divide when we're using the concept of growth between a descriptive reporting out versus a normative evaluative element of what we're doing.
So something like growth or progress, in one sense, it is just true that a plant grows, and that's we're not evaluating or making a moral statement about that. But you're saying that in the context in which you're using these words, in fact, we do think that growth and progress are good.
Right.
And we use them to mean that, even though that moral value is sometimes kind of hidden.
Yeah, indeed.
And so then, could you talk about how you describe these concepts of growth and progress in 20th century industrial economy as morally situated, and then how interdependence comes into the picture as relevant and attractive to people?
Yeah, this is a long history. We're thinking about histories at the scales of hundreds of years of development. But if we're thinking about the moral concept of growth or progress, the idea of growth itself is a organic or bioorganic idea, as you just said, like a plant growing. And that organism metaphor is going to be important for folks thinking about the shape of a society or society as an organism, society as a whole, right? As like a total organism, in terms of where it becomes relevant for our conversation, thinking about environmentalism, Buddhist environmentalism, is going to be tracking the development of capitalism. And so if you want to do that, then you want to start tracking what are developments in this entity capital that currently is governing, call it our society's basic structure. We can start to see notions of progress and growth, which have evaluative elements to it as like, progress is good. And that's the way it's used in these kinds of earlier 17th century moments when reformers are trying to envision a better society. They are using the term progress in these kinds of positive ways. Everything can be improved on. Children can be improved on. The poor can be improved on. That's the language that's happening in the 17th century stuff. Metals can be improved on. So anyway, you get these kinds of usages of progress and improvement.
In an environment where growth and progress are morally valued,
yeah,
there's a vulnerability to an idea like interdependence,
I think the way you put it.
Is that right?
Indeed.
And I thought that was a very nice turn of phrase to put it like that. And I wonder if you could expand.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, indeed. There's a way in which this entity capital is denaturalized, cast in mathematical terms. It's not tethered as it might have been in the past to a metal. It's not tethered to land. It's a number. It's an abstract entity because it's so unbounded. A concept like Pratityasamutpada or interdependence offers, why we're vulnerable to it, in other words, is that we are due for actualization, but call it kind of like rematerializing, where we're thinking of organisms as a whole. That's why I think interdependence, or Pratitya Samuppada translated as interdependence, is a valuable contribution. It's a really appropriate idea with which you can swap out the idea of unlimited growth.
And you also then tie that to different models of causality, which I think is what you're saying without having yet used the word causality, but where this model of perpetual growth and progress is a linear model of causality, whereas the idea of interdependence implies this metabolic, you say, model of causality, which is then implies all kinds of other different ways of organizing social systems or even experience.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, indeed. Indeed. If we're thinking of a social system organismically, then there are parts that are in relation to each other.
Mm-hmm. And is this where you come to the use of theoretical biology? You write that you're wanting to situate, and this is your words, situate human social forms within natural history, or to see humans as living fully within the natural historical animality. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that?
Thanks for picking up on that. We might think that this mode of thinking is in line with something like a multi-perspectival mode of treating the human, where the human, it's just one among the myriad things. Human societies are one of many other kinds of societies, ant societies and so on, right? The human organism is not radically different in kind from other kinds of organisms. And then the second thing to think is that there's not some kind of hierarchy where the human is above. So I think those two commitments are interesting and important to me. The thinkers that I read to support some of my thinking, for example, Jacob von Uexküll is writing in a neo-Kantian tradition or a German tradition. One of the first things that got me on this scent was reading J.Z. Smith's Acknowledgments, Morphology and History, and in Eliade's study of religion, thinking through morphology, the synchronic dimension, history, the kind of diachronic dimension. And reading that put me on the track of Goethe, the forms of plants, and so on. As it turns out, the German philosophical literature from the 19th century on is really just chock full of that kind of organism metaphor, tracking alongside real world study of organisms, you know, like that. Part of it is to keep our eye trained on other organisms. It's to keep in mind the real lives and experiences that are happening, in front of us all the time.
Yeah, I can see that how the kind of tradition of German naturalism would then feed into traditions of early American environmentalism. And then Buddhism comes into the scene at some point and it all starts to fit together for people, as you're saying, largely around this concept of interdependence, which you trace the history of this, the use of interdependence as a translation term for the Buddhist concept. Yeah. Would you be able to expand a bit on that? I found that very interesting, the genealogy of that term, because now it's so readily accepted that, of course, interdependence is what that concept means.
Yes. Yeah. It is like the standard translation these days, for sure. Thinking about the environmental movement, you know, it's people writing in the, call it 60s and 70s. You know, Rachel Carson, how is she using these ideas? You see that she's really using this language of dependencies, of things upon each other. What I'm basically doing is saying, look, here's the natural history of a concept. You know, like we may think we know what interdependence is. You know, it is the standard translation for Pratitya Samuppada. But if we look back, we'll see that through the 20th century, there is this process by which the term interdependence accretes this kind of sensibility around it. And even to the point where if you're backing into the 19th century, interdependence isn't going to have that kind of valence, you know, at all. Come the 60s and 70s, where you really have a much more full-fledged environmentalist movement, that talk of dependencies, and then bringing in a Buddhist sources meets with that former usage of dependencies. The environmentalists I selected who self-profess an interest in Buddhist materials are Schumacher, who writes Small is Beautiful, Arne Naess, a deep ecologist, right? He's like reading many things, but Buddhism is certainly one of them. And of course, Joanna Macy is someone who really wants to do that work.
So on a kind of related note, I wanted to ask you about something you we're very careful about, which is to talk about Buddhist environmental agents from North America as well as from the Buddhist world in Asia. So to give examples from both North America, examples of Buddhist environmentalists, but then also Buddhists in Asia, such as the 14th Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or many others that you describe. I think you do that to make the really important point that ideas like Buddhist environmentalism don't rightfully belong either to East or West. Can you expand on that and tell us why that's so important?
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's kind of a tricky subject or maybe a sensitive one, because here's the thing, right? If we track it historically, we see that environmentalism is really a North American phenomenon. But the thing is, I want to bring back this kind of circular metaphor or the organismic metaphor. I think it would be wrong if we said that because the environmentalist movement started in the West, any uptake of environmentalist practices or causes or so on by Asians and Asian society, Taiwanese Sangha or something wants to take on environmentalist practices, which in fact some have, right? It would be wrong to say that because it started first in North America in the 60s and 70s, that means the environmentalist ideas or values is just one more instance of taking on the values of an oppressive hegemon and sort of kind of making it their own. I think that's too suspicious. I think that's not the right way to look at it. I think that there's a way in which we should be able to have what Cora Diamond calls a common intellectual life of mankind, and also a sense then of common human understanding of certain kinds of ills as ills. That in fact, there's good reasons to be worried about certain kinds of environmentalist issues at this really large scale.
Yeah, or you're speaking against an idea that Asian Buddhists are being derivative in taking up environmental concerns, or that they couldn't have sort of come to those concerns on their own, or that they couldn't be agents of those concerns themselves. And so I think it's a very valuable corrective that you make.
Yeah, or even if they're not the first ones to have thought it, or even if they did derive inspiration from North American practices, that like, what's the issue there, right?
You talk about the vital importance of naturalistic ethics. And in light of what you say, I'm reading from your final pages, in light of what we human societies do to non-human animal societies, and in light of the brutalities visited upon them that go unrecognized as brutalities, I wonder, is this a direction in which you're hoping your research will continue and expand? And if so, what are you thinking to do in this kind of naturalistic ethics?
Yeah, thanks so much. What I mean by a naturalism in ethics is the commitments I mentioned earlier in our conversation, whereby I say that humans are kind of alongside other animals. So it's the human animal alongside other animals. We humans, we have certain kinds of skills, capacities, language, and so on, right? And we kind of describe our religious systems based on that, based on being able to talk to each other and you know, being minded in certain ways, being sociable in certain ways. It's to point out how other animals, other minded beings, other kinds of minds, and other kinds of societies, that they do act in ways that we can recognize as moral, right? That there's sort of moral valence in what they're doing. The thing that this is responsive to is to think that there's all sorts of things that we do to other beings who are not like us. And we also think we're above them in certain ways or are entitled to use them in certain ways. One almost doesn't need to recite the list of the things that we know are going on. I mean, we know what happens in factory farms, right? So I guess what I'm trying to get at in this naturalism is to think that we are, in fact, kind of with this array of animal life, we can learn to see animals in the right light, in the ways that they ought to be seen, that maybe there are things that we wouldn't do to them. So there is a way in which knowing things about the animal shows us something about what we're like as humans, but it's also how we are to relate to other animal life.
I can see as scholars that we can do our scholarship in a way that imagines that our human subjects, the human societies we are thinking and writing about as animal societies, and that that might flavor our work in a different way, our scholarship. But we are both scholars in a field that not a lot of people read what we write. And I wonder if you feel compelled to bring these ideas to a larger audience in any way, even through teaching. That's one way that we do reach a lot more people. But how do you express some of these commitments that you have outside of scholarship?
I mean, that's a great question. Last semester, I just had a really special experience with Oberlin students here. I taught animals and religion, and we talked through a lot of this, showing them how there are real stakes if we view animals as radically different in kind from who we are as humans, if we take the animal and human as not fundamentally different in kind, but just differences in degree, that we come to see them really differently. Can we learn to see animals? Can we learn to see them as they are? Do animals have morality? Are there ways in which they have proto-language, you know? What is it to be a human animal among the spectrum of other animals? There's really interesting work happening on ancient DNA. People working in the field are really putting concrete time markers on the deep past. If we're thinking cosmologically, parts of time that are geologic, kind of way before memory, trying to picture what the world might have been like, you know, a million years ago or something like that, it's quite daunting to do. So if we're thinking about what is it that humans are like, what is it that human societies can be like, this chronological map, our deep past or our human origins, is newly becoming available. And it's really, really so cool.
How did you get into these kinds of topics? Do you have a science background, or are you an animal lover, or...
I have always loved animals as like a very small child. And we had a little dog who passed away. And what I found as a small child, something that I didn't comprehend about that, was that why it was that people didn't seem to care. I felt that I cared about this creature, and at least the people around me at the time didn't seem to. And I think that that puzzlement is maybe still the same puzzlement.
Yeah, thank you. That's a nice story. It's always so interesting, I think, to hear how our personal lives kind of appear in our scholarship, in our professional lives.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy. I really appreciate the time that you've given me. And it's so fantastic to hear about this research.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to have this conversation and also to connect.
This episode of Buddhist Studies Footnotes was created, produced, and edited by me, Frances Garrett, with support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Toronto. This project aims to make Buddhist studies research freely available to students and the public.